Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, here at Ten Talk Radio Network Studios, because today I have a special book at the bottom of the hour for Big Ed in the control room. I know he's not always that crazy about another cozy mystery, but I think he's going to love the book that I'm going to be talking about at the bottom of the hour. And then I'm going to give it to him because he will really want to keep it and he won't let me out of the studio unless I do give it to him. But right now I'm going to turn to my first guest, and it's always a lot of fun when I have somebody I really, really admire. So here we go with the first guest, and then we'll talk about Ed's book at the bottom of the hour. I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper an author who I have been waiting to talk to her ever since I got this book. It's a nice, bright red book, and I grabbed it, and I always grab red books or yellow books. And I was so happy to read this book. It is by Lisa Black, New York Times bestselling author, Red Flags, a low-card institute thriller. Wow, wow. Hi, Lisa.
Hello.
Wow. Oh, you are amazing. You are amazing. It's always so exciting to be in on the ground floor when a new series is starting. It's a historical day, and you have come out with the beginning of a terrific series.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you liked it.
Oh, did I like it? I get so many books. I have my sort of game plan, you know, sort of planning my schedule. I don't want to read too far ahead. But then when I saw this book, really, I literally took one look at it, read the beginning, and I sat down, and I don't remember doing anything else for the rest of the day. This is so terrific, and it's so exciting. You have to tell us all about it, but first, let's just tell my listeners who you are, because you are pretty impressive. A lot of people write crime books, and a lot of people always have forensic experts in there, but it's not often that a book is written by a forensics expert.
Yes, I've been in forensics for about 25 years now. I started at the coroner's office in Cleveland, Ohio, then moved to Florida. So I've been with the Cape Coral Police Department for 22 years now. I'm a forensic specialist. I respond to crime scenes. Luckily, we're a relatively low crime area, so most of our crimes are burglaries, etc. So I respond to everything from criminal mischief to homicide.
Wow. And of course, you are an expert at blood pattern analysis. And of course, that's something that every crime writer is always writing about, but not very many people who are members of the International Association of Bloodstain Pattern Analysts.
Yes, actually, as I said, low crime area here, so I don't really get to use that as much as I get to use being a certified latent print examiner. That's pretty much 80% of my work right there.
When you came out with this series, with this idea, that's so exciting when you come out with, you know, an idea for a character. And at which point, how does it come about? Did you think of the characters first? Because the characters are fascinating. You have two doctors, Dr. Ellie Carr and Dr. Rachel Davies. Which one came first, and how did you build on that? Because when did they take over your mind?
It was kind of unusual with this series, because the other two series that I had, I had the first book in mind, and I wrote it, and I wasn't really thinking about a series. And this time, I really sat down and tried to plan out all the elements that would carry a series a long way, that, you know, I needed characters with a complicated backstory and enough, let's just say, baggage to make them interesting and give issues for future books. So Ellie Carr was orphaned. Her mother died when she was 4 in what she always believed to be an accident. Then her father couldn't handle, you know, raising a 4-year-old and left, and she never saw him again. So she grew up with first her grandmother, and then another aunt and a couple of cousins, and then a different aunt and a couple of cousins, and then a different aunt and uncle who were doctors. So she has a very close-knit extended family they were always there for her. So she had an incredibly loving childhood. It was just a bit different than most people's. So she went into forensics. Then Dr. Rachel Davies has kind of the opposite thing. She's got a very stable, you know, very stable home life. She's now divorced and she lives with her mother. She lives with her 2.5-year-old nephew because her sister, we will eventually find out as the series goes on, was killed just as an innocent bystander in a drug deal gone wrong. So she has that little bit of baggage in her life, but otherwise she's very stable. She's been working with this Locard Institute for 10 years. It's her life. And the Locard Institute is one-third research, one-third training for other law enforcement agencies, and one-third private clients. And I invented this system so I could give them a reason to move around the country and deal with all sorts of different cases.
Claire, there are really actually institutes like this that do training for forensic people, and they have all of the facilities, but you've really expanded on it. And as you said, you've opened up so many possibilities. For such.
Yes, that's what I was trying to paint, the broadest kind of picture, so that I have like unlimited opportunities in what I can do with this series.
Exactly. And of course, you've made them very high tech so that they really will be called upon for many interesting and intriguing cases along the way.
Yes. I wanted to give them all the equipment they could possibly, like what you see on TV and what 99% of the time doesn't really exist, is a facility that has every single piece of, you know, forensic equipment you could possibly need.
Like Abby Schuto's lab, that she has everything in that lab.
Exactly. One person, she's an expert in absolutely everything, which, you know, also doesn't really exist.
No, I didn't think so, but it is fun. And it certainly has created an interest, I think, in forensics and in lab work, which I think is fascinating. When I was young, I worked in a hematology lab as a technician. And I can tell you, I mean, as you know, working in a lab, I don't know, I'm not sure how old you are, where you started. Were they still using microscopes when you started?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so you know that thrill of looking in a microscope and looking at blood and discovering something. So actually been wonderful. I hope that more young people will think of working in a lab as a real career opportunity.
Yeah, lab work is really fascinating, and in many different areas.
And very fulfilling.
Yes, it is, because you're trying to establish facts that are going to affect people's lives, maybe in a good way, you know, because it will help them find justice, or it will prove their innocence, you know, or in a bad way, and they'll be going to jail. But, you know, then we're hoping justice is served.
When you started off, you didn't start in forensics, straight in forensics, or did you do before that?
No, my first degree was in political science.
Oh, boy.
Because I loved Washington, D.C., but I loved the architecture. And, you know, all the monuments and the marble, not what people actually did there. So, you know, that was a topic I had absolutely no aptitude for. So I graduated with no marketable skills whatsoever except typing and became a secretary. I was a personnel secretary for 10 years. And during that time, I went back to school at Cleveland State, which was only like a block and a half from where I worked, and got a degree in biology. They didn't have degrees in forensic science then. They didn't even have courses in just forensic science.
Wow, that's a great back. I love it. Of course, in Washington, D.C., you could do some work there on bloodstains nowadays. People are like out of control. So once you got into and biology, again, so often, and that's why I'm happy that they're doing now this STEM type of education. Biology, that was one of my favorite classes when I was in high school. Biology, physics, and Latin were my favorite subjects.
Wow.
And really, it was because of my work in biology that then when I went into getting a job, I got a job in a lab because I just enjoyed, you know, being around microscopes and investigating things, finding things.
Yeah, there's nothing quite like it.
And so from there, you then built up a heck of a resume and a And of course, somewhere along the line, you also, in addition to learning how to type, you learned how to type what? You know, really use words well.
Yeah, knowing how to type 70 words a minute is a big help as a writer. It truly is. So. One good thing that came out of being a personnel secretary.
Exactly. So when you got to this idea of the book, Red Flags, let's talk a little bit about the premise for the story, which, again, now you're able to draw upon the backgrounds of both Ellie and Rachel, and in particular Ellie for this book. I like that it was told from her point of view and looking sort of through her eyes. Explain how you decided to do that and the premise for the story without giving anything away. We don't want to say, you know, it is about a kidnapping in general. So what do you want to say about it?
Right. Well, as I said, given Ellie's background, that she grew up in these different families, for a while she lived in West Virginia with her aunt, who was sort of a little bit of a hippie, and these two girl cousins about her age, Rebecca and Melissa, and they were difficult in some ways because they were always fighting over her. She was like the new toy in the house. So it should have been super fun. At the time, she thought this was great. But as an adult, she can look back and say, you know, this really made her childhood very strained for a couple of years. So anyway, she and Rebecca, you know, kind of grew apart after she was taken to another uncle's house, uncle and aunt, to live with the doctors. Now she's this forensic specialist in Washington, D.C., responds out to report of a baby kidnapped from his own crib in the middle of the day in this humongous mansion with, you know, no one showing up on the outside video cameras or anything, no note, no nothing. As an investigator, she's thinking that doesn't really make sense. Unfortunately, in these cases, most likely what happened is they left the baby in the bathtub or, you know, shook him a little too hard, and now they're making up this kidnapping to explain. It's a terrible thought, but on the face of it, that seems more likely than the kid literally disappeared. But then she gets there at this incredible mansion. The father is a lobbyist with his own lobbying firm, and the mother is a congressional advisor to a committee. Turns out the mother is Rebecca. So, of course, that changes her outlook on the matter.
Exactly, your cousin.
Thinking, you know, she can tell Rebecca's, you know, genuinely grieved, and, you know, she can't believe that she would have done anything to her own child. They also have another daughter who's 11, who was also home at the time. So the whole thing seems really strange, and, of course, she wants to find the truth, and she wants to support Rebecca. And she first asks her boss, should I recuse myself because I'm, you know, involved? This is my cousin. And he says, you know, no, stay there. And the FBI has been called in, of course, because it's a baby kidnapping. Well, I mean, a child disappearance. They also say, no, we want you to stay. And she's figuring they're setting her up as a scapegoat because then if, you know, the case is solved, wonderful. If it's not solved, they can say she was biased or something like that and kind of blame it on her. So she's not comfortable with this whole situation. It's just bad from every point of view, personally and professionally. Of course, it's a family, and she would never abandon family. Well, meanwhile, the husband, the lobbyist, goes to hire the Locard Institute because, you know, he wants the best. He's got more money than anybody in the world, and he's, you know, he's devastated about his child, but he's got some concerns of his own, you know, with this current lobbying client and this bill that's up in Congress that Rebecca is also on the committee for about online gaming and restrictions to online gaming, especially those involving children. So he doesn't quite know what's going on, but he just wants the best that money can buy, and he wants the Locard Institute, and he's got enough pull that the FBI is going to be okay with it. Plus, they know Rachel, and they trust the Locard Institute, so they're kind of okay with it, too. Would that ever really happen in real life? I am not sure. But, hey, it's a book.
It's a book, and you get to use some really fun stuff from your past. You get to use your political science instincts, you know, that understanding a little bit about lobbyists and the power of Washington people. And when they want something, they want it and they get it when they have influence. And so you have that tied in here. So we get a little bit of political intrigue, which is always fun in a book. And then we have, well, we have a diverse range of characters, and, well, we should call them suspects because we really don't know. And, in fact, you have twists and turns in here. So who knows? I mean, I'm not saying that it wasn't the parents, because you don't know, or one or both. Or you know, this is the nice thing about somebody who writes a book filled with suspense. You keep us turning the pages.
That's the goal.
That's the goal. And you did it with this book. Along the way, of course, you also get to talk some detail about some forensic aspects of the case, giving us a little peek into the world of forensics and what's possible and how they accomplish some of the things they do.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
what I was trying to do. I try to present the forensics more realistically than you see on TV, that things don't always work perfectly, that no matter what equipment you have, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get a clear answer, and how these tests and assays actually work.
When you were developing the Lockhart Institute, had several different divisions there that handled different aspects. And one of the things, of course, you mentioned there is the Boneyard. Tell us about this. And this is true. There are institutes that teach forensics, and they actually do have these Boneyards.
Body Farm.
Body Farm. That's what, yeah, I think Boneyard, yeah. Body Farm. Body Farm.
Yes. The most famous one is in Tennessee around Knoxville. That it was like basically the first. Bodies are buried in different situations, like, you know, in water, completely, you know, deep in the ground, on the surface, covered with leaves, exposed to the sun, not exposed to the sun, etc. And then they're observed for the changes over the body and what happens in terms of insect life and everything else over time. At the Lockhart, and as forensic schools often have, they have like a mini version. You know, they don't have human bodies. They use, you know, pigs or other animals that, you know, have died naturally. And, you know, they do the same thing. They just use it as a teaching opportunity. Our local community college here that had a very good forensic science program had that. They had a little island in the middle of the campus that you could get to over this little footbridge, and they would use that. They buried a pig out there, and they had the students all semester long be making observations. So that's part of the Lockhart Institute, and actually that is going to come up a lot in the next book.
As I mentioned, I love being in on the ground floor of book one of a new series, and in this case, book one of a new book series, and then I think also this is also the beginning of a new television series. Because at some point, after you sort of rack up a few more books, I'm sure it'll be optioned and it will turn into a television series. You write very cinematically.
Well, your lips to God's ears, let me tell you. Yes, that would be absolutely fabulous. Hollywood, please come knocking on my door. I will not turn you away.
Exactly. Well, I think they will be knocking. Usually you have to have a few more books and, you know, on the roster, but they will be coming. Because, as I said, you write cinematically. Do you enjoy writing the dialogue? Because your dialogue is very good.
Thanks. I do. You can have fun with that, and you can show people's different personalities by how they word things. You can have somebody say something that you wouldn't say, and, you know, it can be very fun, and it really shows people's personalities and how they interact with each other.
So what is your process?
Just having to do it all in narrative.
Do you set yourself a number of words a day? Do you write using Word?
Yes.
Okay, so not Scrivener.
I type in Word.
Okay, you type in Word.
Usually spend a couple months just planning, just kind of thinking, percolating through the brain, and then I'll finally start writing down. every book I tell myself I'm going to do a much better, more thorough outline. I usually don't. I do write a few things down, but it's usually just like jotted, this happens and this happens and this happens and this happens. And then often I don't even look at it again when I write the book. But once I start writing, I put myself on a word count schedule. Usually, like lately, I've been doing 1,000 words a day, 7 days a week. Then once I start, I just keep going until I end, because I have this fear that if I stop, I won't start again. I'll take time off for vacations and national holidays, not a complete slave driver. And then I'll go back and start rewriting and, editing and doing the second draft, and that'll usually take another couple months.
Your agent must be really happy with this book.
I hope so.
I think your agent is going cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching.
Yeah.
I have a feeling.
He'd like to be doing that, I'm sure.
Well, I have a feeling.
Fingers crossed.
When you get a series like this that's exciting, the characters are engaging, characters that you want to know more about, and you have a lot of Easter eggs in there, so you can plant a lot of things in advance. You know, this is what makes a great series. And when I read the book and I found that you get a certain tingle when you know that a book is going well and the story is carrying along and, you know, engaging you. And that's what I felt when I read Red Flags. And I was really, really thrilled. I remember as soon as I read it, I finished reading it, and I immediately ran to my computer, wrote the publicist. I said, this book, I'm going to have this book on my program, because I just felt so strongly. It is a beginning, you know. It's like when the first Rizzoli and Isles came out, and then, you know, years later, you're watching reruns of the television show. I think we'll be in that same position here with your wonderful, wonderful book. I think it's really great. Again, it is called Red Flags, a Locard Institute thriller. It's by Lisa Black, New York Times bestselling author. Boy, she's going to have a television series, and she's going to be you'll also get to be right there on the set, giving all the advice and technical advice. So you have a lot of things happening in your future. Your second book's already done?
Yes.
Of course. Yeah. As soon as you have a date for that one, I'm eagerly looking forward to it. And meanwhile, what is your website you want people to go to?
It's lisa-black.com.
Okay, lisa-black.com. This book has set you on a whole path of glory, and it's called, again, Red Flags. It's available wherever books are sold, of course. I'm sure the bookstores will be happy to carry it now that bookstores are open again. Isn't that nice? Because it's got a red cover, and I think people will grab it. It's really great, and it's called Red Flags. You've got a hit here, and I'm just so happy that you've been on the program today. Lisa Black, Red Flags. Everybody get this book. It's a great read. Thank you again for being on Joy on Paper. Lisa, I think you're fantastic.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
It's really a fun interview.
Okay. You take care now. Okay. Bye-bye now.
Okay. You too. Bye.
Bye. All right. Well, I really enjoyed talking to her. Now, we're going to have some commercials, and then I'm coming back with a book just really special for Big Ed in the control room.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go GOEHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with the Z. And I am back, and I am just waiting for my next guest. And as I said, this is a special book that I wanted to get for Big Ed, and I'm hoping he's going to call in a few minutes. Meanwhile, I want to remind you that Bill Larson is going to be on the program in 2 weeks, and we're going to be talking intellectual property. And make sure that if you have any questions about intellectual property, send it to me. And at patsy.radio@gmail.com, and I will give it to Bill, and he will answer your questions. There have been some really interesting cases lately about intellectual property theft and people who think they can get away with it. Anyway, I will have that, and I also have a lot of my best interviews are right on the front page of my homepage website, Radio-Joy on Paper. That's Radio-Joy on Paper. And I hope that you will go there and listen to these interviews. These are some of the recent ones that I've had. So I've really, you know, been trying to get this whole website up and running in a big way because it's been difficult. There were a lot of changes with WordPress, and it was a big deal. But I am getting there. I am catching up. And so once I get that all done, it's going to be great. Is he on? Big Ed? Big Ed is shaking his head, and this is not good. I'm waiting, because this is an interesting book, and I have been, as I said, you know, I have so many different... The wonderful thing about Joy on Paper, really, is I have such an eclectic assortment of authors. I go from one subject to another, but that's very much like my reading. I read everything. I mean, I'm one of those people who reads everything. I read the ingredients on a cereal box. I read everything, but I have this wide variety. And one of my favorite, of course, is National Geographic. I love Nat Geo books, and I'm always thrilled to have a Nat Geo author on and to promote Nat Geo, because I believe Thanksgiving Day should be National Geographic Day, and that everybody, instead of bringing flowers or bringing wine, when they go to visit somebody on Thanksgiving, they should be bringing a National Geographic book. And there are books for everybody. And of course, my favorite, there are the books for kids, because I believe that kids should read more, and everything I can do to help kids just embrace and have that love of reading. I did not realize that 50% of Americans only read at an eighth grade level, and that's absolutely wrong. One of the reasons that I read so well is I started reading Nat Geo books when I was three, well, Nat Geo magazines when I was 3 years old. And so that's why I love Nat Geo books. And the book I'm talking about today, National Geographic Kids Book, it's called It's a Numbers Game, Football. And it is written by a great historian, Eric Zweig. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
Wow, I am so happy to talk to you.
Well, sure we'll have fun.
We will, because...
It's Zweig, by the way.
Zweig, what did I say?
We're early in it. Yep.
I'm nuts. Zweig, yes, I know that. Why? I think it's, you know, I get people having different pronunciations of names. I had Levine, a few weeks ago. I get so crazy. Anyway, you're on the program. And the funny thing is that, of course, you are a big sports fan. You have a wonderful, wonderful record of all of the wonderful articles you've written. And it's funny that, you know, I get you for this book, which is football. Now, I spent a lot of time on the field, but I was in uniform, but I was in the marching band. So I realized that, you know, I never understood football. I don't know football. I'm coming to this book completely. You know, I lived in Europe for many years, in England, and I became a soccer fan. Soccer I know very well. Harry Kane, I know everything about Harry Kane because I love him. I'm a big Tottenham fan, went to many, many games. But football, other than being on the field, marching along with my flute, I really didn't pay any attention to it, except, of course, for the players' tushies. that was sort of my vision. So I was so happy when I got this book because, one, I get to learn a lot, and it is a beautiful book. You are fantastic. You've done a wonderful job with this book. I love it. Of course, it being a Nat Geo book for kids, the photos are great. The stories are great. The articles are great. And I love all the extra things that you do for kids, because I want you to talk about one example. And this is something that I know my brother, who is in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, he's a Youper. He will be listening to this program, and he will love to hear about the ice bowl and about... Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, it's funny, boy. You've brought up so many things that I'd be interested to chat about. But we'll talk about the ice bowl. You know, I'm a Canadian. I grew up in Toronto. I still live near Toronto. We had a very frozen Grey Cup final a few years after that. That kind of is the Canadian ice bowl. But the ice bowl you're talking about in the Upper Peninsula, I guess, is because it was Green Bay. Green Bay and the Dallas Cowboys in. I guess it was 1967, the NFL championship. This is when the NFL and the AFL were still rival leagues, though we're now playing each other for the Super Bowl. And it was one of those freezing cold. This is maybe the day where the frozen tundra of Lambeau Field sort of came into legend, with this like minus 13 Fahrenheit and the, you know, frostbite and people losing fingernails and things in the cold. It's actually I was alive, but it's before my memory of sports, but it's one of those legendary things in football history, especially if you're from that region.
Oh, yeah. And my brother, of course, is a big fan. And it's funny because really when you look at it, you know, Green Bay is a tiny place to have such a big and important team.
Green Bay is an interesting story. I mean, like the Packers... The history of the Packers dates back slightly before the NFL, but it's strange. Like, they are this small-town success story. I mean, at the time when they started and when they were winning their first championships in the 20s and 30s, I mean, the NFL was not this huge monolith that it is now. But still, I mean, the towns were bigger. You know, it's the little town of Green Bay playing in Chicago and New York and Pittsburgh and bigger American cities. But they were good. They won, and they've always had this huge community support. I mean, everybody talks about now how, and you know, maybe Pete Rozelle had this tremendous foresight, or maybe it was just lucky that NFL teams would share the television revenue evenly, so a little town like Green Bay can compete with the big markets like L.A. and New York and Chicago. But back then, it was just, you know, grassroots, you know, fan interest in a local area that built up this great team. And then, of course, the 60s, Lombardi, again, it's before the huge money, but it's just the local support and the community involvement. I think it's always made the Packers a big part of football.
Oh, and the fans are crazy. My brother is crazy. He's got everything, all the sports stuff. His man's cave is really right. filled with it. And for people who don't understand, when we talk about Ice Bowl in Green Bay, it was negative 13 degrees below zero.
Yeah. That's cold even by Green Bay standards.
Yeah, well, you know, as a Youper, I was born actually in a blizzard. So I know what it means. And most people, you know, I tell people, well, how cold is that? And I say, it's colder than if you put your head in your freezer and leave it there.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, it'd be much colder than that. Nobody freezes things that cold.
No, negative six is about as cold as your freezer goes.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're and to sit through a game and to cheer them on and to be, it's fantastic. And what I love about this book, it's, of course, being a Nat Geo book, it's smart and clever. It has a description in here about, and it explains for the kids what it means to be that cold. And also, even they have a section called Pencil Power so that kids can figure out the difference between centigrade and Fahrenheit.
Yes, well, that was because that section has the Canadian game and the Grey Cup game in 76, I think it was, and the Ice Bowl and hottest temperatures and coldest temperatures, and it seemed like such a natural. I mean, they, as I said, I'm from Canada, and I think that's just a fluke that they reached out to me to do this, but I think they found it interesting that it would be somebody who understood Canadian football a little bit, because they sell these books in Canada, so they wanted some Canadian content. So in a math book about football.
Well, it's important, and I think that it's great for kids to have that. And I'm sure a lot of kids will actually take pencil to paper. It's a kind of challenge that, well, yeah, how do you figure that out? And, you know, when they teach it in school, you're not really interested. But when you're thinking about it in terms of football, next time they watch a football game and they're saying, oh, it's, you know, this temperature, a lot of the kids will actually know something. Which is nice.
Yeah, well, that's what I think. I mean, it's funny, we've talked about this with a lot of people today, and I've said, like, you know, they asked, you know, is it, because it was, I think, a question that was prompted to you guys, you know, does being a football fan, you know, and help with math, does being good at math help with football? I don't know that it does, but I do think for kids, like for me, I was not a kid who liked math and science. It always seemed like, why am I learning this? What relevance does this have for me in my life? But I hope when they read this and see how much sort of math and numbers and science are kind of hiding in football, that they'll realize, huh, you know, there is something interesting in this and why that happened and how this happens. And you know, it might not make them better at math, but it might make them at least more open to the idea of studying math. I'm not a math guy myself, so I think this would have helped me with that if there was a book like this when I was young.
Well, I think so. And it is wonderful how Nat Geo just hones in on how to help kids learn something in a fun way. That's the best way for kids to learn, when they're learning about something fun. So, you know, as I said, I don't know anything about football. I do. Oh, and I also want to mention the Roman numerals, explaining to kids this is a way for kids to understand math. And there's a nice little section in here about Roman numerals.
Yeah, that seemed like it's funny. Like, some of the stuff, I never realized, like, how are we going to get so much math and science into football? But, like, the Roman numerals, it's funny, I you know, they taught me Roman numerals when I was in school, and it was always hard to remember. And then I remember we were on a family vacation. Funny, you mentioned you spent so much time in England. We were on a family vacation in London, and we were at Westminster Abbey, I guess, and there were all the tombs of long dead British, you know, people of importance in Britain. And it was like actually looking at those old tombstones and seeing, it was like the first time, like, Roman numerals, oh, you know, I still don't really understand why they used them, but like I understood, like, that represents this number. That represents 5 feet away. That DCCC is 500, 600, 700. With the M in front of it is 1,000. It was like it all came together. So I thought it would be a fun way, because they used the Roman numerals for the Super Bowl, and that was really just a sort of funny way to try and make the game seem more important and classic and legendary. But you know, it was a fun way to explain how the Roman numerals work. And then we did make up a few little mathy problems, like, hey, solve the answer and then convert your answer into Roman numerals.
Yeah, this is exactly the kind of cleverness that Nat Geo has with reaching children, which is so important.
Yeah.
And, of course, with...
Well, I think I'll take credit for that one. Much of this book, you know, it was they're genius at what they do, but I think I came up with the Roman numerals idea.
Wow, you're a genius!
I am a genius.
You are a genius. And so, now, of course, the kids, most kids who are coming to this will already know football because kids are raised on football and they know all about this, all about this stuff that I don't understand. I only have really met, since high school, and college, I only met one sort of gotten to know one football player, and he's somebody I just found so interesting, and it's because of a football term that I did not know about, and that is the word sacks. I didn't know what a sack was, and then I met Al Bubba Baker, who played for the Detroit Lions, and he was famous for doing sacks, which I thought, that's pretty interesting.
Well, it is interesting that it is, you know, it's kind of the ancient term of sack, like to sack a city, to lay siege to a city. Apparently, it's Deacon Jones, who was a great defensive lineman in the 1960s with the Los Angeles Rams, who kind of coined the term. I mean, guys were always tackling the quarterback for a loss, but, I mean, he was the one who apparently came up with the term sack. But this is, I have to say, like, as I've said, I'm not really a math guy. I'm more a history guy. So those are the stories that I find interesting and am happy to write about. It was more of a challenge to incorporate the math and science, but I think we've done a good job of balancing everything in this book.
Oh, absolutely. All the touchdown percentages and interception percentages, I think that's, you know, you made it something I actually can understand. I think that's great. And of course, all the, I think the individual stories about some of the players and who was who. What particular ones do you like? Well, running of the goats, what is that?
Well, you know, it's funny. My brother and I have used the term goat for years to mean the way it used to be meant, sort of like you were a goat, you were it was your fault, like from scapegoat. And suddenly GOAT has become this acronym for greatest of all time. So where to me, you know, a goat is still somebody who, like Bill Buckner was a goat when he blew that ball in the 1986 World Series. That's a goat. Like now GOAT is the greatest of all time. I just thought running of the goat was funny from the running of the bull. But personally, I'm not a fan of the phrase goat, but it's so out there now that you couldn't avoid it. So the running of the goats in this case was just a list of the greatest running backs of all time.
Now, what was the most unusual unusual thing that you discovered while you were researching for this book that you didn't know before you started?
Yeah, well, I've always known, and I think most people, you know, even Americans who know Canadian football, about the only thing they know about it is the field is bigger in Canadian football. And it was, you know, researching and reading about the early history of the game, the Canadian football as it's still played today, which has three downs instead of four and a 110-yard field instead of 100, a wider field, Canadian football is closer to what football was when it first started developing away from rugby in the 1870s, and I thought that was pretty interesting. The most fun story I found didn't actually make it to the book because I guess it was too much history and not enough math, was the story of this gentleman. I honestly, I should have looked it up. I can't remember if he played it. I think he played at Princeton in the 1880s, and he kicked a 65-yard field goal 1888 or so. Or maybe 1882, doesn't matter, a long time ago. And it was interesting that he kicked it, and it was kind of noted at the time, and then fell away from any kind of history. And then as early as, like, 1915, it was kind of resurrected. And then there were, like, could a guy really have kicked a ball that far at the time? And, you know, people who, yeah, I was at the game, I saw him do it, here's how it happened. And then eventually, like, he comes forward and tells his story. It was so much fun to sort of just dig into that. Like, that's the nerd stuff that I like, the history and the quirky stories, but I think it was too history and quirky for to fit in the book. But I posted it on my website a few years ago when I first found it, and it was a fun story for me.
Well, there's so much in this book that is absolutely wonderful, all about defensive formations and defensive nicknames and defensive statistics. And this is a wonderful book for kids. I hope that everybody out there will get, if you have a, well, I don't know, I think it's also a wonderful book for women. If you're a guy and you want your girlfriend, wife, or whatever to understand football, and I'm not trying to be sexist here, but I don't think most of us understand this. Get this book. It's beautiful. It's you've done a wonderful job with it. I know that actually baseball is your favorite game, right?
Yes, I'm a big baseball fan.
Me too. I'm a Tigers fan, and I, as a matter of fact, I kissed Mickey Mantle many times, and he kissed me back.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah. I was, you know, like 3 or 4 or 5 years. My dad was with the Teamsters, and we always had seats behind first base. And so my dad, I went to a lot of games with my dad. And when I was little and, you know, cute little girl, Mickey Mantle kissed me. So I had lots of fun with that. And, of course, one of the greatest things is that I was not there on the day that it happened when Mickey hit 535 at Tiger Stadium.
Right. Yeah.
But my father was. And I always think if my father were alive today and he had to do a password, you know, you had to put some number on a password, he would put 535 because that was a pretty spectacular event for anybody who was in the stadium, in Tiger Stadium, which I love Tiger Stadium. It was so wonderful.
Tiger Stadium is where I saw my first game.
Really?
Yeah, 1973. We didn't have a team in Toronto yet, and I have cousins in Detroit, and we went to a game.
Oh, wow. So you know the joy of it was such a wonderful place.
It was a great old park, yep.
I've never, you know, I still love baseball, and I'm still a Tigers fan. As a matter of fact, right on my front seat of my car, next to me, I keep my Tigers cap, I live in hope, you know. We live in hope. Right? You can't give up your... And I'm still a Lions fan. I mean, what can I do?
Yeah, there's where you have to keep your hope.
Oh, yeah.
A long time of terrible...
Oh, too long.
Hoping with no real reason to.
Well, I'm always happy to talk...
I'm a Maple Leafs fan, so I understand that.
Yeah. Well, I'm always happy to talk to somebody who... has been to Tiger Stadium, and I want to really thank you so much for this wonderful book. It's beautiful. It is, of course, a National Geographic kids book. It's called It's a Numbers Game, Football. And you have other books, but do you have a website where people can find out more about you? And, well, actually, where they can read more of your stories and your blogs, because you are a terrific writer.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. Yes, my website is just my name, ericzweig.com. So that's ericzweig.com. There's a section that lists all my books, and there are, yes, the section where I just... A lot of the stories are hockey-related, but not all. Lots of sports. And I do feel like, you know, I can... You might say, oh, I'm not a hockey fan, why would I go? But if you have any intellectual curiosity... And enjoy history, I think you'll find something that you'll like.
Oh, because you are a terrific writer. Are you, by any chance, related to Stefan Zweig?
No, my father's name was Stephen. I could give you all the whole kind of Jewish history and geography, but it's not actually our real family name. It's one of those changeable.
One of those changeable, because, of course, Stefan Zweig was a brilliant historian. Yes. But you are a great sports. That's a great sports historian, and it's wonderful that you have, you know, worked with Nat Geo on this book. As always, I always tell everybody, if you don't have a kid in your family that you want to buy a Nat Geo kids book for, buy one book, order it on Amazon, and have it sent directly to a children's hospital. If you don't have a children's hospital in your area, send it to Shriners or St. Jude's because kids in hospitals need books, and because of COVID, they don't share books like they used to. So
no, I guess not.
Yeah, it's a big problem. It's a very big problem. They just cannot share books. So the children in hospital need books. If you want to do something wonderful for somebody today, just go to Amazon, order this book, order it for any kid in your life or any woman in your life who doesn't understand football like me. And you've done a beautiful job with this book. I'm just really honored that you were on Joy on Paper today.
Well, thank you very much.
I think you're terrific. Okay?
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
I enjoy talking with you too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Okay. Oh, isn't he nice? He's so nice. Oh, this is why I'm crazy. Yes. Anyway, it's Eric Zweig, and go to his website because he does have, when you have a good writer, whatever he's writing about, it's just so much fun to read. And Nat Geo, I want to thank them as always for this book because I love this book. It's just beautiful. And buy it and send it to a kid. When I think of the kids in the hospital here in our area, we have St. Jude's Hospital and also the Children's Hospital in St. Petersburg. They need books. They desperately need books for children. And any kid in the hospital, any kid in the world would love this book. It's so beautiful. And as always, it's when you get something from Nat Geo, that just that bright yellow there, that when I was a kid, when we got our Nat Geo magazines in the middle of winter, in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, where we lived in an ice bowl in my part of the world. Our life was in an ice bowl, and we would get that magazine, and we'd open it up, and we'd see this yellow magazine, and we were thrilled because it was an eye opener, and it was our sunshine. So anyway, remember, I'm again, one more reminder, send your intellectual property questions to patsy.radio@gmail.com, and I will give it to Bill Larson before he gets in there. And meanwhile, I want to just remind everyone that one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry and her wonderful, wonderful books in two series, The Haunted Haven, which is set here in Florida, and Witch City Mysteries. Book number 12 is out, and it's called Till Death, and you should get that before book number 13 comes out. Well, you can pre-order that too. Anyway, I'm going to give this book now to Big Ed because I know he will love it. Everybody have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. And if you're not writing, start writing and say something nice to somebody today. And I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything you do for me. And I'm glad that I would give you all the cozy mysteries, but I know that you will appreciate this one. It's a numbers game. Football. Bye.